All right, we're going to continue now with our forum of presidential candidates. And to introduce our next guest will be a member of CMP, and that is Marjorie Dannenfelser. She is the president of the Susan B. Anthony's list. She is a regular contributor to Fox News, CNN, CBN, and others. She has published in the Washington Times, the Washington, the Weekly Standard, and other national publications. She and her husband, Marty, live with their children in Arlington, Virginia. Please welcome Marjorie Dannenfelser to the podium.
I have the feeling that this room is not full for me. This room is full for a very special man, Dr. Ben Carson. I know that a lot of you know him already, have met him. He's met a lot of you. And whenever you meet him or talk to him or see him on TV, don't you go away with this idea, this thought, there is something really different about this guy. Some of it is really obvious, and I think the polling numbers really communicate some of the really obvious stuff. There's no question about that. But one of the things I love about CNP is that we really get a little deeper. We get to know each other on a more fundamental level. And I think that will be true of this moment that we have with Dr. Carson. There are two things that I think are really unique and special about this man that I have been blessed to get to know. One is that he truly understands on a very fundamental level the connection between human rights and civil rights and how they are the foundation of our nation's greatness and how those things, human rights, are the connective tissue. You like how I said connective tissue when he's a neurosurgeon? I thought that was good. They are the connective tissue between citizens. It's the basis of trust. And in fact, his conversion on the pro-life issue had very much to do with that connection in itself. He, in commenting about the very first, very powerful pro-choice movement in this country, the pro-slavery movement, said, when he was explaining about how his change of heart came about on the abortion issue, said, I began to think, if abolitionists a long time ago began to think that I don't believe in slavery, but anybody else can do it if they want to, where would we be today? They changed my opinion. That changed my opinion on a whole lot of things. A whole lot of things speaks to how foundational human rights and civil rights are in this country and how he understands this uniquely. He reminds me, especially because my organization is named after Susan B. Anthony, who fought for women's rights to get involved in the political process, of a moment when Susan B. Anthony and Frederick Douglass together traveled to the Republican convention, both Republicans, in Minnesota, and communicated to that convention one thing. They stood there together after a long, hard-fought battle over which rights should move first, the rights of women to vote or the rights of African Americans to be acknowledged as human beings. Which one will go first? Well, of course, they both believed that in the connectedness of human rights. You can't build human rights on the broken rights of another human being. So they came together to that convention, and they said to that convention gathered there, you may not choose. We are bound together. You accept one of us and our rights, you accept both of us. This is something that Dr. Ben Carson understands in so many ways, in such a foundational way. That's why he believes, like we all do, that the targeting of Planned Parenthood of African Americans hits especially and acutely painful. That Margaret Sanger believes that anybody, any human being, would be human underbrush that should just be washed out of society, and that legacy lives on today in the targeting of Planned Parenthood's abortion clinics. There's another thing, and it's the final thing, it's the second thing about him that I think is incredible, not news to you, but is just true, and that is that within the understanding and knowledge of his astounding accomplishments as a human being in his life, that he even more so has riveting humility. That is the sign of a servant leader every single time. This man was the, as you know, was the first person to successfully separate Siamese twins. They were conjoined at the head with a team of 70 people over 22 hours, the first successful one. He turned down a West Point appointment to go to Yale. This was after being raised by his mother only in a less than ideal situation. He was the youngest director at age 30 at Johns Hopkins to head a major division there. Why? Because skill was all that mattered. He's a survivor of prostate cancer. He was called and named by the Library of Congress a, quote, living legend. How many living legends have a lot of humility? Not a lot. So probably the most important point of my introduction of Dr. Ben Carson is that he will not fit in, therefore, in Washington, D.C. And isn't that just the point? His servant leadership will be, potentially, if he wins, a beacon. And with that, I give you Dr. Ben Carson.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much. I'm delighted to be here today. Normally, my wife Candy would be here with me as well, but she's out campaigning. She's been in Iowa the last couple of days, and then today she's in Birmingham, Alabama. We discovered that she's an excellent campaigner. You know, we didn't really know that before, but she's just blossomed into it. But you know, I am always grateful to see people who are interested in values and principles, because I believe that it's those things that really distinguish America from so many other places. And America is an incredibly unique and special place. There are a lot of people who say, oh, nah, we're not exceptional. We're no different than anybody else. But is that really true? Remember, before America came on the scene, people did things the same way for thousands of years. Within 200 years of the advent of America, men were walking on the moon, fundamentally changed the trajectory of mankind. And when you think about the rapidity of success, you know, we declared our independence in 1776, and less than 100 years from that time, we're the number one economic power in the world. Think about that. That is incredibly exceptional. And America remains the land of dreams. And the people who denigrate America and say that, you know, we're the worst place and we cause all the problems in the world, what are they talking about? Have they noticed there's a whole lot of people trying to get in here and not a lot of people trying to escape? You know, that should tell you something. And for me, it was certainly a land of dreams. I dreamed of becoming a doctor. It seemed like an unlikely thing, but it really wasn't. I skipped right over firemen and policemen, went straight to doctor. I loved anything that had to do with medicine, on television. I even liked going to the doctor's office. I wouldn't even mind getting a shot, as long as I could smell the alcohol swab. You know, that was good. And but those dreams seemed unlikely, you know, for a kid who had the nickname of Dummy. That's what everybody called me. The other kids loved the fact that I was in the classroom because I was the safety net. You never had to worry about getting the lowest mark in the class as long as I was there. But my mother was so distressed that I was doing so poorly. And she didn't know what to do, so she prayed for wisdom. And that's the wonderful thing about God. You don't have to have a PhD to talk to him. You just have to have faith. And he gave her the wisdom to know what to do, to turn off the TV, to make us read books, to make us submit written book reports to her, even though she couldn't read them. You know, those were the things that made the difference in my life. And it gave me a very different impression of who I was. Within a year and a half of starting that program, I went from the bottom of the class to the top of the class, much to the consternation of all those students who used to laugh and call me dummy, who were now coming to me saying, Benny, how do you work this problem? And I'd say, sit at my feet, youngster, while I instruct you. I was I was perhaps a little obnoxious, but it sure felt good to say that to those turkeys. But you know, getting the academics under control, you would have thought that everything was going to be okay, but it wasn't. Because I had a horrible temper. I was one of those people who think they have a lot of rights. You know, the more rights you think you have, the more likely someone is to infringe upon them. So people are always infringing on my rights. Every time I turn around, somebody hit me with a pebble. It didn't hurt, but I was incensed that he would dare hit me with a pebble. He picked up a large rock, hurled it at his face, broke his glasses, almost put his eye out. Another fellow was trying to close my locker. I didn't want it closed. Socked him in the forehead with my fist. Unfortunately, still had the lock in my hand. Put a 3-inch gash in his forehead. My mother was trying to get me to wear something. I didn't want to wear it. Picked up a hammer. Went to hit her in the head with it. Fortunately, my brother caught it from behind. Other than that, I was a pretty good kid. But you can see how, you know, that temper can really get the best of you. And when I was 14, I tried to stab another youngster with a large camping knife. He had on a large metal belt buckle under his clothing, and the knife blade broke, and he fled in terror. But I was more terrified than he, recognizing that I was trying to kill somebody over nothing. And I locked myself in the bathroom, started contemplating my life, realizing that I would never realize my dream of becoming a physician with a temper like that. My options were jail, reform school, or the grave. And none of those appealed to me. So I knelt on my knees and I said, Lord, you gotta help me. I can't control my temper. And there was a Bible, and I picked it up and opened to the book of Proverbs, and there are all these verses about fools. And it seemed like they were all written about me. But then there were the verses about anger. Like Proverbs 19:19, no point getting an angry man out of trouble. He's just going to get right back into it. Proverbs 16:32, mightier is the man who can control his temper than the man who can conquer a city. Verse after verse, chapter after chapter, it seemed like they were all written about me. And I came to an understanding during that 3 hours in the bathroom that to lash out at someone, to punch someone in the face, was not a sign of strength. It was a sign of weakness. It meant that you could easily be manipulated. And to always be angry was a sign of selfishness, because everything was about me, my, and I. Somebody did this to me. They took my thing. I want this. And if you could just step outside of the center of the equation and let it be about someone else, it would make a tremendous difference. And when I came out of that bathroom, the temper was gone. I never had another problem with it since that day. And you know, and some people say, you just learn how to cover it up. But I'll tell you something, when God fixes the problem, he doesn't do a paint job, he fixes it from the inside. And it has been extremely useful to me. Now, some people say, oh, he looks like he's asleep all the time, and you know, he's just too calm and too mild-mannered. Well, don't mistake being calm and mild-mannered for being weak. Because, you know, you face a lot of tough situations. And I certainly faced a lot of tough situations in my career. A lot of very difficult things. But if you had sat me down in front of a computer and said, I want you to type out the career that you would like to have, I could not have typed out a better career than what the Lord had in store for me. But learning so many different things and pushing the envelope, always thinking about how something could be done rather than why it couldn't be done. Because you were constantly hearing, can't do that. No one's done that before. It's impossible. Now I've reached a stage in my life where I don't even want to do anything if somebody doesn't say it's impossible. You know? So, you know, when all the pundits said, you can't possibly, you know, run for the highest office in this land, never being an elected official, and you can't raise money, you can't put together an organization, I said, yeah, this is great. I was glad to hear that. But you know, one of the things that has become so important in looking at our nation and recognizing that it's moving so much in the wrong direction. And one of the things that really convinced me to get into the fray was hearing from so many elderly Americans who said that they were just waiting to die because they had given up on America. And younger ones who were so concerned about their children and their grandchildren. Because it appears that right now we're in the process, as a nation, of giving away all of our principles and values for the sake of political correctness. And it is destroying us. It's destroying our identity. It's destroying our vision. And the Bible says in Proverbs 29:18, without a vision, the people perish. And they lose sight of who they are. It makes a difference. We look at our Constitution, which I think was a divinely inspired document. You go back to 1787 in the Constitutional Convention. The whole thing was about to fall apart. The large states and the small states, they all had different opinions about how things should be done. But before it fell apart, the elder statesman, Benjamin Franklin, got in front of the assembly and he said, gentlemen, stop. He said, during the Revolutionary War, every other phrase out of your mouth was God save us, and now you don't want to talk to God. He said, let us kneel down and let us seek wisdom from the Lord. And the whole assembly knelt and prayed. And when they got up, they put together a 16 and a third page document known as the Constitution of the United States, which is one of the most admired documents and lasting documents for any society in the history of the world. And if we were actually smart enough to follow the document, it would make such a difference. You know, the First Amendment talks about freedom of religion. Not freedom from religion, but freedom of religion, which means we have the responsibility to protect the belief systems of our citizens. And as long as your beliefs do not conflict with the rights of someone else, you should be able to believe what you believe. But look at what's happened. You know, we have a system of checks and balances, and it actually works extremely well when all three branches of the government do what they're supposed to do. It does not work well when one of the branches is non-functional, which is what we have right now. We have a legislative branch which is non-functional. They just have become the peanut gallery, watching the executive branch and the judiciary branch do whatever they want to do. And that necessarily will cause those other two branches to overstep their boundaries. You know, for instance, with the recent ruling of the Supreme Court on gay marriage. Now, first of all, I should say I have nothing against gay people whatsoever. And I think everybody is protected by the Constitution. Everybody has equal rights. But nobody has extra rights. Nobody gets to redefine everything for everybody else and then make them conform to it. That's called overstepping the boundaries. Now, we do have a solution for that, though. What the Supreme Court did, I believe, was inappropriate because, first of all, the Constitution says that civil matters should be handled at the local level, and the reason for that is because the people are the ones who should determine what the criteria are, not some oligarchy. And they knew that at the local level, judges and legislators would be subject to the will of the people. But when you take those issues and you move them up into the federal system, then you have people who have no obligation to the populace making the rules about how people live. That was never the intention in our country. But there is a remedy for it, the legislative branch, who should have known what the implications would be of that ruling, and that people would be losing their jobs, losing their livelihoods, their reputations, everything because of that ruling. And they should have had legislation ready to go already that protected the religious liberty of every American who actually believes what the Bible says. And that's a problem. And it's going to be vitally important that we elect people to Congress who actually understand that and understand that they actually represent the people. And the people are getting extremely frustrated because they keep sending people to Congress, election after election after election, and nothing changes. And then people just keep doing the same silly stuff. And, you know, we're ready, I think, for some backbone. That's what it's going to take. Somebody who's willing to put the spike in the ground. And, you know, you then look at the Affordable Care Act and the things that it forces upon people, again, against their religion. And, you know, you go back to Roe v. Wade. Again, an issue that is a civil issue that really shouldn't be taken to the Supreme Court should have been done at a more local level. But the fact that it has been taken there, I think it needs to be reviewed. And the reason it needs to be reviewed is because we know a lot more about babies in the womb now than we did 40 years ago, almost 50 years ago. And so we need to update. You need to look at the 14th Amendment again and the rights that it guarantees for life. Because now we know we can look at that ultrasound. We can look at the endoscopic images of that little 10-week-old. And you see the little eye sockets and the cute little nose and little fingers and toes. And you can see movement and you can see the heart beating. It's real hard to say that that is not a living human being. Very difficult. And I was talking to the head of the ACLU, and he was talking about how they are the ones who protect those who cannot speak for themselves. And I said, well, there was a little baby. A woman came to me. She was 33 weeks pregnant. She was on her way to Kansas to get an abortion. And fortunately, I convinced her not to get the abortion. 33 weeks now, that baby is viable outside of the womb without life support. But they would still kill that baby in Kansas. But anyway, she didn't do it. She had the baby. We had to do a little operation, but the baby's fine, and she's so happy with that baby now. But I said to him, now there's a human being who's viable outside of the womb. Will you speak for the rights of that baby? Oh, he hemmed and he hawed, and he just couldn't come up with an answer. Well, later on that evening, I was talking to him again. I said, let me make it easy for you. I said, in the neonatal intensive care unit, we have a lot of little babies. And they are like 24, 25, 26, 27 weeks gestation. They're in incubators. They're getting full life support. How about that baby? Can you advocate for that baby? Oh, yeah, no problem. I said, but the one who's several weeks more advanced and is in the safest place it can possibly be in his mother's womb, you cannot advocate for that one. And he says, well, I realize that that doesn't make any sense. He says, I actually believe the woman has a right to kill that baby until the second it is born. And I said, would you say that in public? And he said, no. But that's the mentality. That's the mentality that exists out there. And it's the same mentality that has created the hatred and the division that exist in our society today. You know, you have people telling you that there's a war on women, race wars, income wars, age wars, religious wars, any kind of war imaginable. They stoke up strife between the people. And we've become so much coarser because of it. If you notice when you read an article online and then you go to the comment section, usually you don't have to get more than 5 comments down before people are calling each other all kinds of horrible names. You know, where does that hatred come from? I'll tell you where it does not come from. It does not come from our Judeo-Christian roots and values. And we must learn to identify what is actually happening to us and who the people are who are trying to divide us, because the strength of this nation is our unity. And Jesus himself said, a house divided against itself cannot stand. We must recognize that it's okay to disagree with someone. That doesn't make them your enemy, to be destroyed. And what we must learn how to do is engage in civil dialogue and talk about our differences, because we will then discover that we're not as different as we think we are. And we probably have a lot more in common than we have apart. And I always say, if two people agree about everything, one of them isn't necessary. And I think everybody is necessary. So it's a matter of just talking about it. And those people in our society today who are trying to kick God out and say that we are not a nation with a Judeo-Christian foundation, that we shouldn't be talking about God in public, do they realize that our founding document, the Declaration of Independence, talks about certain inalienable rights given to us by our Creator, aka God? Do they realize that the Pledge of Allegiance to that flag says we are one nation under God? That many courtrooms on the wall, it says, in God we trust. That every coin in our pocket, every bill in our wallet says, in God we trust. So if it's in our founding document, it's in our pledge, it's in our courts, and it's on our money, but we're not supposed to talk about it, what in the world is that? In medicine, we call it schizophrenia. And doesn't that explain a lot of what's going on in our nation today? And we need to make it perfectly clear that in this nation, it is okay to live by godly principles of loving your neighbor, of caring about your fellow man, of developing your God-given talents to the utmost so that you become valuable to the people around you, of having values and principles that guide your life. And if we do that, then we will truly have one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Carson. We have, as you know, the Council for National Policy is an umbrella organization of many different conservative organizations and conservative leaders representing issues in the area of domestic and social policy, foreign policy, and fiscal policy. So we have a number of our members that have submitted questions, and we'll be calling on them to ask questions representing those various elements of the conservative movement. Beginning with Dr. Alveda King, who's going to ask a question regarding kind of first principles.
Dr. Carson, you have clearly stated and demonstrated that you are not politically correct on issues such as Islam and the sanctity of life. How heavy is the price, and how challenging is it to toe the line on your convictions?
Well, now that's a very good question. As anybody knows who's been paying attention, the left-wing media does not like me. And, you know, every day, you know, it's something else. I mean, they are just, they're just going nuts trying to find something. Here's their big problem. In a way, I feel sorry for them. I was so busy, I didn't have time to get in any trouble. There's nothing to find, you know? So they're just, there's got to be something. You know, so he left a sponge in somebody's head. Oh, yeah. Oh, we got him. Well, you know, when you do a microvascular decompression, you're supposed to leave a sponge in there. That's part of the operation. It's just that most people don't react to the sponge. That's all, you know. But, you know, I would be more concerned, quite frankly, if they didn't do that, if they weren't scrounging around and going berserk, because it would mean that I wasn't getting to them. And the fact of the matter is, what they are doing to this country, the secular progressive movement, we need to get to them, and we need to change what's going on.
Very good. Our next question is in regards to economic issues, and Joseph Farah is going to ask that question.
Dr. Carson, there hasn't been much in the way of debate on the issue of the debt limit and our, you know, $18.5 trillion debt that we're facing as a nation right now. And I wanted to ask you a two-part question. How would you approach that issue as president? And secondly, you know, at what point would you say simply no to any suggestion of raising the debt limit?
Well, what you have to recognize is that we get to this point every single year, and nobody talks about it until your back is up against the wall. And what I would do is I would start at the beginning rather than at the end of the fiscal year. And I would say, we are going to cut several things here. First of all, one of the first things I would do in a Carson administration is call a joint session of Congress, tell them that we work for the people, they don't work for us. And I would say, I will not be signing any increases in debt at all, period. None. Okay. Therefore, let's start now, ahead of time, looking at where else we can reduce. We have 4.1 million federal employees. That's ridiculous. And, you know, thousands of them retire every year. We will not be replacing any of those people. We will simply move people around. There's 645 federal agencies and sub-agencies. They all have a budget. And I would require that they all cut their budget by 3 to 4%. Now, I know Nancy Pelosi says, you can't even cut one penny, it'll be a disaster. Well, too bad. You know, I guarantee you that there is fat in those budgets, and it can be cut big time. And, you know, that would save us a lot of money, but you also declare that we're not going to increase federal spending by one penny. You do that 3 or 4 years, and you automatically have a balanced budget just like that.
On the social issues, Gina Gleason has a question regarding a marriage decision. Gina, in the back.
Hello, Dr. Carson. We know that you already talked about this issue, but that you're such a gracious man that you'll answer it again anyway. Since the recent Obergefell decision, where five lawyers imposed same-sex marriage on our nation, we have seen good Christians, such as Kim Davis, be persecuted and jailed by the government. I have two questions. Do you accept this decision as settled law? And two, if you are elected, what specifically will you do from day one to ensure that conscious protections are enacted and respected?
Well, is it law? Yes. Is it settled law? No. No more so than Roe v. Wade is settled law. You know, we will continue to fight it utilizing the channels that we have. I think there'll be an opportunity to put in some more Supreme Court justices because certain ones will be retiring or moving on in some other way. And I don't read anything into that, but there will be an opportunity. And you look at the life record of someone, not what they say in an interview, but what have they done? What has their life demonstrated to be their belief vis-a-vis our Constitution and how it should be interpreted? And I think we'll get the right kinds of people if we do it that way. And I think that's exceedingly important. And I think also providing the right kind of leadership to Congress will give them the backbone that they need to create the kind of legislation that will make sure that we don't infringe upon the rights of Christians, people who actually believe that there's validity in the Bible. Because the fact of the matter is, here's the real issue. If you can negate substantial portions of the Bible, both New and Old Testament, through this law, then you can eventually negate all of the Bible. And I think that's what the real agenda is.
Hmm. Let me ask you about that, Dr. Carson, because you've been very vocal on the campaign trail, making reference to Scripture, and recently your eschatological views were called into question. Given the media's hostility toward religious expression, do you plan to scale back or increase your comments about the Bible?
Well, the Bible's an important part of my life. I start every day reading from the Bible. I end every day reading from the Bible. I start every day praying. I end every day praying. I pray throughout the day for wisdom. I'm not going to stop doing that. I don't care what anybody says, because it's part of who I am. It's sort of like, with the movie that came out, Gifted Hands, that Cuba Gooding Jr. was playing me. As that was being produced, the major sponsors came up and they said, you know, this is a movie for a general audience. This is not for a Christian audience. There's too much God in here, and you have to take it out. And I said, I have no argument with you. you can take it out, but you also have to take me out because it won't be about me. That's the way it is.
Dr. Carson, immigration has become a pretty prominent issue in this election cycle. We have a question on immigration from Jay Mount. A microphone over here, please.
Thank you. Dr. Carson, America's foreign-born population is now measured at 42.4 million people, or 13.3% of the total population. In fact, that's up about a million from 2013 to 2014. And when you think about it, this transformative mass migration of people has taken place without any real discussion in Congress, any approval of Congress, or really any real discussion of the American people. So our question is two-part. One is, on the illegal side of that, how exactly will you secure the border? And then on the legal side of it, are the numbers right? Is the number of legal immigrants coming, is it the right number? Should it go up? Should it go down? What do we need to do on that side of it?
Well, we need to make sure that we maintain the culture of America. America is a very special place. And have you noticed that you can be un-American, but you can't be un-French, or un-Swedish, or un-Nigerian? Have you noticed there's an American dream? There's not a Canadian dream or a German dream. So we want to maintain our culture, and we want to maintain our identity. And we should take that into consideration as we're bringing people into this country. We also need to recognize that we have tens of millions of people in this country already who are not doing well. And, you know, when you get on an airplane, there's always this announcement, in case of an emergency, oxygen masks will drop down. Put yours on first, and then administer eight to your neighbor. Right now, we need oxygen, and we need it badly, and we need to, you know, take care of the people in this country before we bring in another flood of people. And then as far as securing the border is concerned, we don't have to reinvent the wheel. In Yuma County, Arizona, they cut down on illegal immigration by 97%. And that was without using the early detection system and drones, by putting in a double fence with an asphalt road in between for quick access, and they actually had border guards, real people at the border, who were, you know, within visual distance of each other. And they also prosecuted first-time offenders. It wasn't the catch-and-release program that we have now. You know, a combination of those kinds of things. We have the ability to close the border. We just don't have the will to close the border. That's all.
Dr. Carson, back on the social issue front, Mike Ferris. Dr. Mike Ferris has a question.
On Neil Cavuto's show this year, you said that you hoped that women who were raped or the victims of incest would use the RU486 morning after pill. Then the host asked you if you believe that life begins at conception. You answered that life at least begins when the heart is beating. Your campaign responded to these and other issues concerning the right to life with the response, you can't legislate morality. My question is, are you actually politically pro-life? You know, I know you're personally pro-life, but are you politically pro-life?
Okay. Well, when I said life begins with a heartbeat, and when I said at least that, the point in saying at least that is that that is something that almost everybody can agree with. I believe that it starts at conception. And if you prevent conception from occurring, then I don't believe that that's the same as abortion. And if you use RU486 or another progestin-based product at the right time in the cycle, then you can prevent conception from occurring. So if someone is raped and they immediately get to the emergency room, it can be determined whether or not they fit into that category. That's what I was talking about. But no, I believe it's at conception. And I believe that once conception has occurred, anything that you do to kill that baby is murder.
Another front, on freedom front, Ken Cuccinelli, former Attorney General of Virginia.
Good afternoon, Dr. Carson.
Hi.
Glad you're here. What is your view of the proper balance between security and liberty as it relates to government surveillance, such as the NSA's gathering of our telephone metadata? And do you believe that action violates the Fourth Amendment?
I think it clearly violates the Fourth Amendment. That's what the amendment says. You may not, you know, engage in illegal search and seizure. And the thing is, it is so easy to get a search warrant. If you have suspicion that someone is dangerous, someone is doing something that's illegal, there are judges available 24/7 who can give that almost immediately. So there really is no excuse for this kind of invasion of privacy, and it clearly violates the Fourth Amendment, and it shouldn't be tolerated.
One final question before we go into our lightning round, Dr. Carson, and that is on the issue of foreign policy, and Frank Gaffney will ask that question.
Dr. Carson, back here, thank you very much for being here, and most especially for your clarity and your courage and your leadership in helping the rest of us understand Islamic supremacism and jihad and Sharia. I want to salute you for that.
Thank you. Well, the reason I understand that is because I've been talking to you.
The cat's out of that bag. Thank you. Let me just say, especially in light of several of your answers today, that one thing that is very much on my mind, and I think on a lot of other Americans who are concerned about the world we're in, that is becoming more dangerous, as you know, by the day, in part thanks to our own government's actions, is the condition of our military. The instrument that we are likely to have to rely upon, at least in part, to contend with these dangers. We've seen it hollowed out by the budget cuts. You've just talked about maybe 3 to 4% more in cuts. I'd like to know what you think about the fact that, by some estimates, $1 trillion has been taken out of the defense budget or will under sequestration. We've had social engineering taking place, a wrecking operation, I think, on the morale of the United States military. And of course, the assault on religious freedom, you've talked about that in general, but it's true in spades in the United States military these days, with, as I say, impacts on morale, on recruitment and retention, and on readiness. My old boss, Ronald Reagan, I know an inspiration to you, believed in peace through strength and practiced it. I'm standing here next to his former attorney general and counselor. This is a moment when we need that kind of leadership, it seems to me, again. I wonder, do you envision providing it? And if so, will you seek explicitly a mandate to provide it, which Ronald Reagan used to great effect when he was elected?
Well, thank you. If we don't get the military right, nothing else matters, particularly in the kind of world that we live in right now. You know, we have a Navy that is the smallest size since 1917, Air Force since 1940. As you rightly indicated, sequestration is cutting the heart out of the personnel. You know, we have units that are not ready to be deployed that should be ready to be deployed. The morale is at its lowest ebb we've ever seen. We have a 14% decrease in the number of people who are applying for the volunteer military. That's hurting us. And, you know, if that trend continues, we may have to reinstitute the draft at some point. I think it's a whole lot easier, quite frankly, to fix a way that we take care of the military than to reinstitute the draft, which will cause all kinds of problems. And we have 22 to 23 of our veterans who are committing suicide every single day. And what we need to do is bolster our military, and it needs to be done quickly. We need to take care of our veterans. They all should have health savings accounts, and they should be able to go any place they want to get taken care of, including the VA hospital. And you know, we should, I would still have every agency cut their budget by 3 to 4%, including military agencies. But there's a lot of other places that I would do reasonable things, like applying Lean Six Sigma tactics to every single agency so we turn them around and make them efficient. That's going to save us a ton of money, and then we can use that money to bolster the military. So it's not robbing Peter to pay Paul. It's going, because there is waste in the military too. So it's creating a lean, mean machine and then using the resources that we do need in order to bolster the military and make it the kind of fighting force that it needs to be. In addition to that, you know, when it comes to the safety of our people, we need to be thinking about the electric grid, which is not hardened as it should be, with private-public relationship partnerships. We can harden that grid. We can have multiple layers of safety there, because all it would take was an electromagnetic pulse from the sun or an explosion of a nuclear weapon in our exo-atmosphere, and we're back 40 years. And then we're very vulnerable to our enemies at that point. We just can't let that happen. Cybersecurity. You know, we have pretty good offensive tools. We don't have what we have, what we need in offensive tools, and we need to activate them. You know, if somebody attacks us in cyberspace, we need to hit them back so hard they will never even think about it again. You know? And we need to get back into space. You know, we have to pay $77 million every time we send an astronaut up with the Russians. That's pretty expensive. And what we need to recognize is that during our space program, we had so many discoveries, all kinds of things, including your cell phone. We need to get that edge back that will help us with our advances, both militarily and in civilian life. And remember, in the future, he who controls space controls the earth.
All right, thank you, Dr. Carson. Now, these final questions, these are just questions we're asking all the candidates, and if you can keep your responses to 60 seconds or less, we'll go through what we call our lightning
round. Just like in a debate.
Just like in a debate, except we will call on you here. What is the single greatest threat facing our nation today, in your opinion?
I think the thing that will knock us off most quickly is our failure to be fiscally responsible. We have $18.5 trillion national debt, which has all kinds of implications. But worse than that, we have the fiscal gap, the unfunded liabilities versus what we expect to bring in. And that fiscal gap now sits at over $200 trillion. The only reason that we can sustain that is because we are the reserve currency. We can print money, which we're doing irresponsibly. We disconnected it with the gold standard back in 1971. And we probably have limited time to fix this. We have the most powerful economic engine the world's ever known. We can get it revved up again by getting rid of the unnecessary regulations, fixing a tax structure so that we have something that is truly fair across the board.
Speaking of those regulations, if you're successful in being elected as president, will you immediately rescind President Obama's executive orders, and how will you use the power of executive order?
Well, pretty much all of his executive orders will get rescinded. No question about that. And how will I use them? The way that the Constitution says you should use them, and that is when Congress is out of session and something urgent needs to be done, which will be a temporary measure until they come back.
Your mother sounds like she was a very wise woman, and I'm sure she probably used the same phrase my dad used to use, the birds of a feather flock together. Who do you run with in terms of conservatives that are in your inner circle of counselors that we might know that are movement conservatives?
Frank Gaffney. General Bob Dees. Lisa Cohen. Armstrong Williams. There are several people.
You have spoken a lot about your faith, and I want to ask you specifically, if you were to be successful in being elected President of the United States, how would your faith guide you in that process?
Well, I think pretty much the same way anybody's faith would. Some people say that they don't have faith, that they're atheists. But atheists have faith too. Everybody has faith, and everybody's faith informs how they relate to other people and what they think. They may just not know it. So, you know, my faith tells me how to relate to other people, to treat other people fairly in the same way that I would want to be treated. And I think that's going to be the biggest difference between perhaps me and what we currently have, in the sense that I do not believe it is reasonable to pick and choose winners and losers. And I think, you know, if you're going to be the president, you have to be president of all the people. And I believe that if you treat everyone the right way, and if we understand the principles of the free market, the power of the free market, and we also understand the principles of compassion. See, this is something we have not really fully realized in this country. Free market capitalism mixed with compassion. And I don't think there's any other system that even begins to compare with that.
What would you say is makes you most unique, or the unique leadership aspect that you have that's different than the other candidates in this race, other than the fact that you're truly a brain surgeon?
Well, I think that that has a lot to do with it. You know, doctors are trained to make decisions based on evidence and not on ideology. And I think that's going to be the difference. I'm always going to be saying, well, wait a minute. Let's look at the facts. And let's look at what happened when we did this before, and the time before that, and the time before that. And then let's look at this, and let's look at what works, and let's analyze why it works, and then let's apply that to the issue at hand. And what I'm really just talking about is common sense. And that seems to be very uncommon these days. I think we're going to have to rename it uncommon sense because they don't seem to have it.
We know that the landscape of America culturally, domestically is in trouble. We look at foreign policy. The next president is going to have to not just stop what this president has done, but undo it. And that could make you unpopular. Are you willing to be a one-term president?
I'm extremely willing to be a one-term president. Be able to go and play golf and learn how to play the organ and read all those books I was saving up when I retired and watch the movies I've never seen and never have to set my alarm clock. Oh, man, this would be great. It would be too good to be true.
One final question for you. You're here seeking the support of conservative leaders from across the country, and we're thankful that you came and spoke to us and took our questions. But we have one final question for you. If you were to succeed in this election and to become President of the United States. Will you come back and continue this conversation with us here at the Council for National Policy?
I would be most delighted to come back and continue this conversation. And, you know, one of the things that will be very important to me is I'm going to have multiple groups. I'll have some business leaders. I will have faith leaders. And because I think in order to govern the people, you have to know what the people think. And it's not a matter of what you think. It's a matter of what the people think, because the country is supposed to be of, for, and by the people. And most of the people in this country are actually people of faith and people of values. And the president says that we're not a Judeo-Christian nation, but he doesn't get to decide. We get to decide what kind of nation we are.
Dr. Ben Carson, thank you so much.